right around the time that deinstitutionalization was happening, we had a bunch of these homes that were left almost vacant. And because people who were leaving them, they were moving to the suburbs. Even those buildings on Jameson, et cetera, which were set up to be kind of like the new modernism, were only part of the answer. And they were built in the 50s, and even they were starting to like lose their luster. So everybody was moving to the suburbs, and so there was a high vacancy rate, and houses were very cheap to buy. And so enterprising people bought them, put a bunch of locks on all the doors, and rented them out. No standards, right? So, but that's what was happening. At the very time that deinstitutionalization was going on, people said, oh, well, I can become a boarding home operator. And so people set up little homes for special care or whatever. People were living five to a room. So, you know, Pat Capone, who, of course, worked here, her first real book was Upstairs in the Crazy House, and she talks about a boarding home that she lived in, Shannon Court. And, you know, the conditions are pretty deplorable. That was the standard. So Park began as a response to, you've got all these adults living in rooming houses and boarding homes. If you're living five to a room, you're probably not going to stay in your room. So you're going to end up then being on the streets. So volunteers and other people said, well, we got to do something. So they proposed Park. And Park opened a few years later as a response, a place for people to go. That was the Living Room to Thousands piece, because people didn't have a place to go. As soon as people came to Park, they started to talk about where they lived. And as soon as they started to talk about where they lived, we were going, holy shit, that sounds terrible. And so you can imagine that, you know, that workers would immediately start to say, well, you know, we got to do something about that. And so, and Bob started, you know, he can give you some pretty good historical context, because he worked at Archway. But he did a lot of his work in the boarding homes, and he saw all of these sort of terrible places. So, Park members' experience and Park's kind of role was really to reflect and comment on the what members would tell us about their lives. So, you have these sort of overlaying issues because housing is a foundational piece of your life. If you don't have a place to live, whether it's home or not, so the first thing you need, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you get I need shelter, I need food. And of course, we're constantly struggling with the fact that people, if you're very poor, you can afford one of the two, but often you can't afford both. So you can afford shelter. If it's not affordable, it's going to be, so there's rent geared to income housing, and then there's affordable. We have a lot of private market affordable housing in Parkdale, which means that it's a little cheaper than the rest of the market. It's still probably 80% of somebody's ODSP check. It's affordable, but they've only got $100 left for everything else, right? So then they don't have enough money for food. So you start to, we realize, well, it's actually not just housing, although housing is key. But then from there, what's next? Well, food, right? And then from there, it's social purpose, like meaningful engagement, having a connection, not feeling vilified or demonized. So, because people who are different, how well are they welcomed by a community? How well are they supported by a community? Are they, are they shunned, or are they kind of like, no, that's so-and-so, and we know them, and you actually have a relationship with them? So there's this sort of these concentric circles of need and demand that have led to what Park does. So we started off very small place, housing activism. Then, then realizing once we got the building and renovated, we thought, well, actually, we have to provide housing. We can't not, because there was a big debate about whether we should ever provide housing, because we couldn't provide enough for everybody. But it was like, well, that shouldn't be, we should provide some for some. And we should learn about that. Because, of course, I think that what's really important about that is that decision, which was really quite a pivotal one for the organization, it then led us to say, when we proposed Edmund Place, we had a track record. We say, well, we've done this for a number of years. And it also meant that for the wider community, we could say, we could start to point fingers and say, well, we do it, right? And then that led us to other issues around poverty, and then to food security, and now we're even a broader one, which is really about social inclusion, because as gentrification continues, the pressure is really being felt, is that we know that without mechanisms to prevent exclusion based on just financial exclusion, etc., that Parkdale will lose its vibrancy, but also some key members of its community. So we now need to look at, from a community development point of view, of like, okay, we need to have a much wider sphere of influence. Like, we can't just, so it's that we've now broadened again to say we actually need to hold that conversation within the neighborhood about who lives here and how, who has the right to be here, and how do we start to talk about making sure that people aren't dislocated due to economic factors. How do we make sure that affordable housing, supportive housing, how do we talk about the kind of neighborhood that we would like to continue to have, right?